Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, what has changed in Syria and Yemen since Trump came to power? Today, an insider reporter looking on the ground. From Paris, Vanessa Bealey. She is an investigative journalist who is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, Gaza, and Yemen. And she's an associate editor of the 21st Century Wire. She was a member of a peace-finding mission in Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. She was in Aleppo during and after its liberation, after the city had been captured for almost 5 years by Western-backed Salafist terror organizations. She is credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable voluntary organization, the Syrian Civil Defense, or better known as the White Helmets, which was actually nominated and won a short documentary by the Academy in Los Angeles. She also is explaining why the White Helmets were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize when they should not have been. She's a contributing writer to Global Campaign to Return to Palestine, The Dissident Voice. She manages a website called The Wall Will Fall in London, where she blogs about her travels and reports from the Middle East. She just recently returned to Paris from Damascus, Syria, where she was doing investigative research. Her websites are thewallwillfall.org and 21stcenturywire.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back on, Gary.
There is an important development in Syria that is getting some attention now. It is the mainstream media's reporting of a massacre in Ghouta in Syria, a region immediately next to Damascus, and it's Damascus' breadbasket, but they're blaming it on Assad. And the Western countries are calling it another massacre. There are claims of 700 killed. In the bombing of hospitals, a UK organization is claiming 194 people were killed in the past 40 hours. And The Guardian is still arguing that Assad used sarin gas in this region. And the media is quoting the White Helmets for its reports. Please deconstruct these arguments and tell us the truth of what is happening.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. I mean, I think it's, first of all, very important for me to point out that when I was last in Damascus, I was actually staying in what is effectively known to be the majority Christian area of Babtuma in the old city. It's one of the most beautiful areas, actually, of Damascus, close to the admired mosque, which was originally a Christian church and then converted into a mosque, which is, you know, very indicative of Syrian society, the blending of Christianity and Islam and actually any minority religions and communities into a very multicultural society. And that is largely what actually the majority of the Syrian people, you know, rather than having this constant reductionist argument of it all being about one man, about President Assad, what it's effectively about, this entire conflict, is the Syrian people as a whole unified behind the Syrian state. Because, you know, again, the state itself does not consist of one man. There are many members of parliament. There are many members of the various subsections of parliament. There are many members of Syrian civil society who are rebuilding Syria from the inside. And that is very often completely eliminated or eradicated from particularly corporate Western media narratives. So it's very important to make the point that the conflict that is ongoing inside Syria is not about one man versus, it's not the hero-villain narrative that we're being given by the corporate media, which of course is their typical regime change war narrative, which is also always going to include the pseudo-humanitarian pretext under which these proxy wars or direct wars are waged, such as in Iraq, for example. So that's, as I said, a very important point for me to make. But going back to the fact that I was in Baptouma, which is an area that is predominantly Christian, and which on a daily basis is targeted by mortars, by missiles, by explosive bullets from the eastern suburbs of Damascus that are occupied by a number of terrorist factions, predominantly Jaish al-Islam and Nusra Front. Nusra Front is al-Qaeda. And we know from experience that wherever Nusra Front is present, they will be the dominant force. So they will have control over any other sort of rebranded or remonikered faction that is fighting alongside them or occupying alongside them, as in this instance. Now, those eastern suburbs of Damascus have been occupied for a number of years now. Those terrorists have dug tunnels underneath those districts, and they basically live within the catacombs underneath those districts. I went at one point very, very close, in fact, virtually on the front line with Jobar, and I was in a building that used to be the Syria Civil Defense, the real Syria Civil Defense, which had to be requisitioned by the Syrian army because actually members of the humanitarian organization, the Syrian humanitarian organization, were being targeted on a daily basis and assassinated by the terrorist factions in Jobar. So that building, their headquarters were moved a little bit further away from the Jobar front lines, and that building was taken over by the Syrian army as a defense point against the terrorist factions to prevent them entering the Syrian civilian and citizen areas that border Jobar. Now, through the windows of that building, which were completely sandbagged against sniper attacks, and in fact, I wasn't able to actually effectively look through the window. I could just basically put my camera lens through the window to try and get some idea of what Jobar looked like. And it resembles a lunar landscape. I mean, the buildings are destroyed. There appeared to be no human beings moving in the landscape that I was looking at, but I was told that in the buildings themselves there were snipers basically waiting for any sign of human life, and then they would basically fire. So that proved to me the fact that these terrorist factions are basically living underground, and they operate from underground. And that's what makes these areas, as an urban warfare situation, very, very difficult to navigate and negotiate. And so the Syrian government, rather than precision bombing in a carpeting manner — I'm not allowed to use the word carpet bombing because apparently now it's all about precision bombing — they're not allowed to pulverize these areas because effectively they would take out civilian targets. So the Syrian government has been waging a very low-scale campaign against these terrorists to try and contain them, to try and negotiate with them. At the same time, it has been evacuating civilians from as many areas as it can on a regular basis. I've actually seen the buses leaving with released civilians, with children coming in for medical treatment into Damascus. So there has been a steady flow of evacuees from those areas prior to the uptick in the military campaign that we're now seeing. But the reason for this final decision by the Syrian government and the Syrian army to liberate these areas fully is that because, particularly in the time just before I left Damascus, there was a huge increase in the intensity of attacks upon the civilian areas in Baptouma, but also in other central areas of Damascus city. These terrorist groups, and one has to question, you know, if they are claiming starvation, if they're claiming deprivation, how are they maintaining the rain of missiles down upon civilian areas in Damascus? Who is supplying them with the ability to make these weapons and to keep basically firing them into civilian areas? On one particular day that I was there, 9 civilians were killed. Among those were mostly school children. The terrorists had fired the mortars at a time that children were basically pouring out of the schools and getting onto the school buses. So one, the narrow streets of the city of Damascus would be very difficult to move around in because the buses would be parked up, cars wouldn't be able to move around them. So there would be log jams everywhere with children, literally. I mean, I was in the streets that day. There were children on the pavements, in the streets, everywhere, hundreds of them. And it is that point that those terrorists chose to fire the missiles. So not only were the 9 kills, including a 3-year-old, Elias Khoury, but a number of teenagers were injured so horrendously that they've had limbs amputated since then. And you know, their lives are basically affected by this, and they will suffer from the trauma of this. And those civilians are suffering from the trauma of daily attacks, random attacks, because you can literally walk out into the street and you have absolutely no idea where the mortar is going to land, if it's going to land in the shop next door to you, as has happened to many people on numerous occasions, if it's going to land in the taxis that are parked up to take people, you know, to different areas of Damascus. It's random shelling of these areas, and it can happen at any time of the day. But it usually happens at the busiest times. And so the Syrian government and the Syrian army have taken a very difficult decision, which is, despite the inevitable loss of life that will occur as a result of this campaign, they have no choice but to liberate those areas and to cleanse those areas of the terrorist factions, because they cannot possibly allow the continuation of the daily slaughter of civilians in Damascus City by those terrorist factions. You know, that is, I don't think any country, any government, anywhere in the world would, if they look at that logically and rationally, would object to the decision of the Syrian government and its army. So the fact that we see, particularly media outlets such as The Guardian, Channel 4, BBC, you know, very much looking at the British media. We see them now coming out with a storyline which is actually nothing more than sensationalist propaganda. They're describing it as the next Srebrenica. They're describing it as Judgment Day. They're describing it as hysterical bombing. These are literally quotes that I'm taking out of an article in The Guardian by Karim Shaheen that came out today. And with absolutely no diverging views, no context, no substantiation. So they're telling us that 7 hospitals have been bombed, but they cannot name those hospitals. I've challenged 1 or 2 journalists on this, and they simply cannot give me that information. And I can tell you why they can't give me that information, because there's not 7 hospitals in that area. And so we're seeing, if you like, a repeat spin cycle of exactly what we saw in Aleppo, where we heard time and time again the last hospital narrative, we heard the last doctor, we heard, you know, we heard the last everything, I think. And in reality, I myself was in East Aleppo during and just after liberation, and I can categorically state that not one of the hospitals that they claimed had been destroyed was in reality destroyed. They were all still standing, most were still operating, some had superficial damage, but they were certainly not destroyed, and the majority were still working hospitals when I entered those East Aleppo districts. And very much, I believe, the same recycling of that narrative is now being seen, particularly in East Ghouta. And as I've said, you know, this is not going to be a clean battle. It's not going to be an easy battle. And very sadly, civilians are caught up in it very often because they are being taken hostage and used as human shields by the terrorist factions. I mean, you know, if these so-called freedom fighters and rebels were there on behalf of the civilians, why are the civilians being forced to be on the front lines? And, you know, but nobody is, the thing is that, Gary, nobody is asking these rational questions in the Western media. Nobody is posing these questions. Nobody is investigating these questions. You know, I'm not by any means saying that everything that I am saying is 100% true, but at least I would hope it will encourage people to start asking these questions and to start thinking a little bit more laterally about what is actually happening. And I can tell you categorically that the people in Damascus will be on their knees praying for Syrian Arab Army victory in this battle, without a doubt, and universally, absolutely universally. Even those people inside Ghouta, inside Douma, inside Jobar, will be praying that the Syrian army completes this campaign quickly and that they are liberated from the hell that they've been living under for the last few years. And that's another aspect of it. The media know that as soon as the liberation is completed, there will be a repeat of the East Aleppo testimony being released, which will again show the corporate media to be the emperor with no clothes. They will be seen again to have been responsible for the whitewashing of the terrorist atrocities in those eastern districts of Damascus. And they will be seen to have effectively maintained and prolonged the suffering of the civilians that are being held hostage by those terrorist factions.
Could you please take us through what it's like for the average Syrian to live in Damascus today, and their feelings about Assad and the regime and the Syrian people working together, different religions, because we're not given any of that information by the mainstream media?
Yeah, of course, Gary. I mean, first of all, if you don't mind, I would just like to correct the lexicon on regime, because the terminology of regime is used to substantiate the demonization of the elected Syrian government. And I think, for me, it's a painful reminder of how the Western media is maintaining such a hostile propaganda campaign against, as I said, you know, it's a reductionist argument to continuously use Assad as the primary villain in this, you know, in their narrative. I mean, it's Syria is not about one man. Syria is about 23 million people. The people in Damascus, as I said, will be 100% behind the army in the campaign to liberate the eastern districts. That is, I can categorically, I mean, you know, please, anybody is welcome to go to Damascus and speak to the people there and to hear it for themselves. But I, hand on heart, will tell you there will not be one element within Damascus itself who will not be praying for victory as soon as possible. And I think it's also important to make the point that even while the military campaign is ongoing, the Syrian government will be negotiating with the terrorist factions to try and bring an end to the conflict with as little civilian deaths and damage as possible. So there will be ongoing negotiations with the terrorist factions to possibly end up with the evacuations that we saw in East Aleppo. So that's another point to bear in mind. You know, again, this is not ever really talked about by Western media, except to try and portray it as some sort of demographic ethnic cleansing by the Syrian government, removing terrorist factions and taking them to Idlib. That's completely untrue. The majority of those terrorist factions, if they are Syrian, will not even necessarily have come from those eastern districts. They may well have been shipped in from different areas of Syria to come and reinforce the militant factions that are embedded in the eastern suburbs. So again, that's kind of an important point to make, because it's one that is almost universally overlooked in the corporate media narratives. The people of Syria, not only of Damascus, don't buy into the sectarian narrative that, again, is one of the sort of constructs that is employed by the corporate media to maintain this entire intervention justifying narrative. The Syrian people, anybody that you speak to, will tell you that prior to the conflict, they didn't even know what faith or what sect their neighbor was. It was never a question that was asked in Syria. And in fact, even now, if I ask it purely from a journalistic point of view, I find myself apologizing for asking that question, because most Syrian people will just say to me, look, we're Syrian. First and foremost, we're Syrian. Secondly, we are Shia, we are Sunni, we are Druze, we're Alawite, we're Shia. You know, it doesn't, that is a very much a secondary factor to them. The primary factor to them is that they are all Syrian. And that is why, actually, in my opinion, this entire imperialist project has failed, because I think the United States and its allies totally underestimated the power of that secular state, of the social fabric that brings Syrians together. You know, for a country to survive 7 years of one of the most brutal, oppressive, violent, bloodthirsty, terrorist occupation of their land, and to have survived 7 years of punishing and crippling sanctions, economic sanctions, and to still, if it doesn't matter where you go, whether it's Damascus, whether it's Aleppo, whether it's Salamiya, which is a small town in the Hama province bordering Idlib that is surrounded on four sides by Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, it, even if these people are literally on their knees physically, many of them have been physically injured or maimed by much of the military campaign that's been waged by these militant factions. They will still tell you that even if they were down to the last man or the last woman in Syria, they would keep fighting. And they would keep supporting the army, and they would keep supporting the state. What comes after the victory by Syria over the US coalition and its terrorist proxies? That's up to the Syrian people. You know, I don't talk to everybody who supports President Assad and his government, not by any means. I speak to many opposition members. I speak to many people that don't necessarily support the government, but they will support the government during this time, during this conflict. What comes after is something else. You know, it's kind of when people are looking to the Syrian government to be perfect during this time, that's insane. We wouldn't expect, none of our governments are perfect, number one, but we certainly wouldn't expect our government or our state to be perfect under such absolutely horrendous conditions that this government is enduring and the people are enduring. And yet the very fact that Assad is still as popular as he is, if not more popular than he was in 2011, you know, that should speak volumes. As I said, what comes after the victory, what comes after the removal of terrorism from inside Syria, that is up to the Syrian people, and that should be taken forward by them without hostile international meddling, which is a violation of international laws anyway. So that's, you know, all of those are very important points to make. So while I appreciate it's important to understand what the people in Damascus are thinking, the people in Damascus are thinking pretty much the same way as the people in Aleppo, the people in Latakia, the people in Tartus, the people in Homs, the people in Salamiya, the people across Syria who are not necessarily pro-President Assad, but they are definitely pro the Syrian state, pro the Syrian army. And I think I've made the point before, the Syrian army is not some disembodied entity that is, as many Western media describe it, Assad's army. No, you know, the Syrian army is an army of conscripts. It is young men, young women, who in their previous lives were doctors, were pharmacists, were teachers, were not soldiers. They're not professional soldiers, but they've taken up arms to defend their country. And so to describe them as some kind of militia who is effectively murdering their own people, that is probably, for me, one of the most obscene narratives of this entire conflict, because it doesn't matter where you go. Every single family has a member of that family fighting in the Syrian Arab army, and almost every single family in Syria has lost brothers or sisters or uncles or fathers or husbands fighting in the Syrian army, if not more. You know, many of them have lost cousins. They've lost various numbers of extended family in the Syrian army. So, you know, it's I think what I want to try and convey is the unity of the Syrian people behind their state. And I'm talking about a state, by the way, that is consistently supplying all areas of Syria with food, with water, with electricity, even with internet. And so it's somehow maintaining supply to even the most remote areas of Syria, despite the fact that right from the very beginning, those terrorist factions, particularly ISIS, have taken control of the infrastructure. They've taken control of oil wells. They've taken control of power stations. They've taken control of water supply. And so the Syrian government has had to negotiate with terrorism in order to maintain a standard of living for its people. And it has done that. It has not neglected its people. So again, you know, the way that this government and the army, the people are portrayed in the West is so diametrically opposed to what you see when you actually go to Syria, what you see and hear when you go to Syria.
How are the terrorists, how are the different groups fighting the Syrian people in this one particular eastern suburb of Damascus? How are they getting their food, water, and munitions? Where's it coming from? Who's giving it to them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. It's not something that I have conclusive answers to. But certainly there was a recent video showing Red Cross supplies entering a terrorist-held area and carrying weapons. We know from Serena Shim, a journalist, a U.S. citizen, but a journalist with Press TV, who was murdered in October 2014, after she reported that I think it was the World Food Organization was carrying not only weapons and equipment into Syria, but also terrorist fighters and chemical weapon ingredients. We know actually in the last 2 days that three trucks of chlorine have entered from Turkey into Idlib. So we know that there is potential for another chemical weapons attack, but certainly not from the Syrian government, as I don't believe any of them have been from the Syrian government. And, you know, without going into any detail, even on the Q-Bono litmus test, why would the Syrian government use chlorine gas against the terrorists when it can use way more efficient munitions? And for a number of reasons, it would not be using chemical weapons in this military campaign. But to come back to how is food and equipment getting into those terrorists? Well, the food and equipment is actually coming in via the Syrian government, via the Russian humanitarian agencies, via the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, because they have been maintaining humanitarian aid and supplies into those areas to the civilians. But what is happening is what happened in East Aleppo, in that the Syrian government continued to get humanitarian aid into those areas for the civilians. But the terrorist factions are stockpiling those supplies. They're depriving civilians. They're starving civilians as part of their campaign to maintain control over the civilians. So it's a very familiar pattern. It's a pattern that we've seen in East Aleppo. It's a pattern we saw in Madaya. It's a pattern that we largely saw in Deir ez-Zor, although that was a slightly different situation in the sense that it was ISIS that was besieging the town itself. But where there is an occupation and supplies are getting in, supplies from the government, from a number of humanitarian organizations, the terrorists take control of those supplies. And that is documented. It's proven. I mean, after the liberation of East Aleppo, I myself saw a warehouse that was piled to the roof with 5,000 tons of medical and food supplies that the terrorists had stored in a number of warehouses throughout the districts and then basically not given to the civilians. Most of the civilians were starving. Very few of them had had any medical treatment. So, you know, this entire narrative that the terrorist factions and the White Helmets, of course, who basically are Nusra Front civil defense and in many cases are Nusra Front itself, they're not helping civilians. I think Pierre Lacour, who's a French humanitarian working in Aleppo for the last 2 years, I think he put it most succinctly. He said, look, according to Syrian civilian testimony, what the White Helmets do effectively is they will come into your house, they'll shoot you in the stomach, and then when they save you and take you to hospital and have their photograph taken, they're given the Nobel Peace Prize. And that's it in an absolute nutshell, Gary. That is what they are. They are actors and they are terrorist support groups, right? And they are the ones producing much of the narrative that Western media is relying on. There are no Western media, either in Damascus or in Ghouta or in areas surrounding it. So they are not getting the narrative from the ground. They're being fed that narrative predominantly by the White Helmets. And so it is the White Helmets that are giving them all of this information about the seven hospitals, about the number of people killed. And yet there is no substantiation for that narrative. It is being simply copy-pasted throughout the various corporate media outlets. It's not being authenticated, it's not being verified, and it's not being checked. It's irresponsible journalism.
Recently, President Trump took credit for what was happening against ISIS. He said he eradicated ISIS. How much legitimacy belongs to the United States and how much to Russia and Syria for removing ISIS to the degree they have in Syria, and also the Iraqi government for lessening ISIS in Iraq?
The US can take absolutely zero credit. Neither can the UK government, because I think Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary, has also put out similar claims. It has been proven that the United States government, whether it was Obama or whether it was Trump, actually for me makes very little difference, to be quite honest. There is clear proof that there has been collusion between the United States government and the terrorist players on the ground inside Syria, including ISIS. If we go back to, I think it was September 2016, when under Obama, the US coalition bombed the Syrian Arab army in Thada Mountain near Deir ez-Zor, killing over 70 Syrian Arab army soldiers, and allowing ISIS to advance to strategic positions. But again, under Trump, we've seen the same thing. We've seen in the Raqqa campaign, we've heard stories that have been corroborated of the United States coalition airlifting ISIS fighters away from the battleground. We know that the United States is now training, I think it's 30,000 militants in the northeast of Syria. And among those, we know there to be ISIS fighters. You know, they may well be rebranding it, but people should be under no illusion that this has never been a war on terror. It has never been a war against ISIS. It has been a war against Syria with Iran in the crosshairs. And then, of course, bringing Russia, China, Hezbollah into the mix, and of course the defense and security of Israel in the region, and the protection of another client state, Saudi Arabia, that has been funding a huge number of the terrorists inside Syria along with Qatar. So to come back to your question, the US has absolutely no credit. In fact, quite honestly, it should be considered to be a criminal rogue state for having introduced those terrorist factions, not only into Syria, but into Libya and into Egypt and into Iraq in the first place. So those who take the credit, as you rightly point out, if we look at the decline of ISIS since Russia came into the conflict in, I think it was again, gosh, September 2015 from memory, we look at the rapid decline of ISIS and the rapid advance of the Syrian Arab army once Russia intervened, then it's very, very clear that prior to that, the US coalition battle against ISIS was a smokescreen. I mean, it wasn't happening. In fact, ISIS was flourishing under the auspices of a US coalition war on ISIS. ISIS was traveling for example, I think it was 500 kilometers from Iraq into Syria without any attacks. It was taking over oil fields. So, you know, I think what we're all we're seeing really, ISIS was a tool of the US coalition inside Syria. ISIS is now either morphing into the SDF or it is being it is in collaboration with the SDF. We've seen that there is plenty of footage showing the SDF basically allowing ISIS to leave areas where ISIS had occupied, and then the SDF, which is the YPG, the Kurdish separatist factions that are being power multiplied by the United States, took over those areas. So that, you know, there was a degree of friendly collaboration between both US coalition proxies on the ground, particularly in the Northeast. So for Trump to take any credit for destroying ISIS is just it's hypocrisy beyond description, as far as I'm concerned. And while the United States is still occupying the northeast of Syria, while it is still power multiplying the Kurdish separatist factions, and while there are boots on the ground, by the way, inside Syria, American boots on the ground fighting alongside the what I can only describe as militant, either border militants or terrorist factions, then the U.S. has nothing to congratulate itself. And in fact, the American people should be disgusted that their government is yet again illegally occupying a sovereign nation and causing the destruction not only of an entire civilization, but of its people. You know, it has introduced trauma into a country that it is going to take generations for it to recover from.
You've been visiting and reporting on Syria for a while now, and what you've noticed has changed in Syria and the violence during the past year of Trump's administration compared to Obama and Clinton's policies there. I'd like to know that. And also, could you explain the more recent military role Israel has been playing in attacks on Assad's forces, getting only positive reviews in the American media and the pundits on both the left and the right media?
I think if you're going to compare Trump with Obama, it's not really my area of huge expertise. But if I were to make any judgment on it, I would say, and I'm certainly no fan of either, but I would say Obama to some extent was more reticent. I would say that Trump is more of a... he's more maverick, but he's also more reactive. He's more, it's more of a knee-jerk reaction from Trump. I think with Obama, there was a degree of deliberation. I mean, he backed off on the red line of the chemical weapons. He backed off at a number of occasions. And in fact, I think those audio tapes that were released when John Kerry was talking with the number of opposition activists and was basically apologizing that the United States hadn't done more to support effectively the terrorist factions inside Syria. But I think with Trump, we have a whole new ball game to some degree. You know, I know a lot of people try to excuse what's going on as Trump being controlled by the deep state, that the decisions are not his. But I think regardless of it, I think, you know, we need to remove, again, I think looking for differences between two presidents or even two prime ministers in the UK detracts from the very real fact that there has been a project to take out seven countries, as described by Wesley Clark, with Iran being the ultimate goal, let's say. And I don't think, you know, I don't think we're deviating from that roadmap. And I think that's what we need to keep our eye on. Sorry, Gary, can you just let me know what the second part of that question? Oh, Israel, right?
Well, yes and no. I want to take you a little different direction for a moment.
Okay, sure.
I'd like you to give us your input on what Saudi Arabia and the other countries that support Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, are doing in Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East. And after all the billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars spent by Saudi Arabia and the others using American weapons and technology and surveillance, they have not been able to win there, but they've destroyed hundreds of thousands of people's lives, and the largest cholera outbreak in the world is currently going on in there, and starvation at an unimagined level is occurring in Yemen, and yet that doesn't get any real attention in the media.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this for me is just demonstrates how clearly the entire, you know, regime change war construct under a humanitarian pretext is nothing more than criminal hypocrisy. Because how on earth can these governments, and I include the UK government, I include the EU governments in this, claim any sort of humanitarian interests in either Syria, Iraq, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, in any country, when they are effectively bringing about the destruction of that country? You know, we have seen, again, under Obama, I mean, that war would not have started without the endorsement of President Obama at that time, back in, I believe it was March 2015. The UN peace envoy at the time, Jamal Ben Omar, said there was absolutely no need for the war of aggression to start because the Yemenis were arriving at a peaceful resolution themselves with a coalition government. You know, what it basically was, and again, Yemen is always described as some sort of Iranian-backed Houthi rebel uprising. It's nonsense. I mean, the Ansarullah movement is a movement. It's a popular movement. The Houthis themselves make up a very small percentage of the Yemeni population. But the Ansarullah movement, which is a movement against effectively Saudi Arabian colonization of Yemen and sort of broad-scale corruption through puppet regimes that serve not only the Saudi objectives and interests, but of course, you know, Saudi is a client state of both the UK and the US. And actually, I think it's really important not to overlook the role of the UK in Yemen in particular and in Syria. In my opinion, in Syria, the UK, which of course was the creator of the White Helmets, is in charge of the intelligence operation. It's in charge of the entire PSYOP operation inside Syria, in my opinion. The US is the brawn, it's the muscle, it's the power. But the UK is definitely the sort of the underworld intelligence behind that entire operation in Syria. And equally in Yemen, for me, this is very much about British interests. I mean, it was a British colony. I mean, the British occupied Aden, and they're now, to a large extent, reoccupying. From what I've been told, the British are back in Aden. They are back establishing some degree of military and maybe even naval bases. They have their eyes on gas reserves in the Red Sea. They're in negotiations now, I have been told, with Ansarullah members. I believe that's in Oman. So this is a little bit of a power grab by the British alongside the United States. And of course, you have the greatest beneficiary in the war against Yemen is, of course, the military-industrial complexes, both in America and in the UK. I mean, a sort of, you know, horrendous figures when you look at it. And in fact, I watched an interview with a Yemeni journalist from Sana'a, and he made the very salient point. He said, you know, it's a joke. I mean, the UK is congratulating itself for providing a few thousand pounds of aid to the Yemeni people. And at the same time, it's selling $3 billion in arms to the Saudis to come back and basically bomb the people it's just given some aid to. You know, and this absolutely for me encapsulates the sheer hypocrisy of our countries, Gary, is that they allow, endorse, advocate and wage these wars against these peoples. They destroy entire cultures and civilizations. You know, what we're seeing now is the eradication of probably one of the oldest civilizations still existing in this world. You know, the Saudi Arabia has obliterated places like the old city of, well, it's not obliterated, but it has bombed the old city of Sana'a. It has bombed the Queen Arwa, Queen Sheba, these areas that are historically, I mean, these places cannot be replaced. And there's almost a frightening apocalyptic vision that they want to erase all of these historic cultures from existence and then basically impose another footprint on top, you know, build another Dubai or build another Tel Aviv in Syria. And this, to me, is one of the most terrifying aspects of this. And we as human beings should be terrified by this, because we're losing our history. We're losing our culture through these wars and through these appalling campaigns that are being waged against people who are asking for nothing more than self-determination. And under international law, that self-determination should be sacrosanct anyway.
I know that Iran is not your specialty, but the U.S., Israel, and its Western allies frequently condemn Iran as a terrorist nation because it supports Hezbollah in Syria. Nobody discusses Hezbollah's role in the Syrian war and its support for the government. What can you tell us about the role of Hezbollah in the conflict, its relationships with the Assad government, and the accusations of it being a terrorist organization with the U.S. Is putting on a par with ISIS?
Well, I mean, look, we know the only reason that Hezbollah is described, I mean, it's part of the political process in Lebanon. It is, you know, it's a recognized, it's exactly the same actually as Hashad al-Shaabi in Iraq, which is now a recognized entity inside Iraq. It is working with the Iraqi government. It's working alongside the Iraqi army. It may well enter the political process. It has to, I think members of Hashad al-Shaabi would have to leave the organization itself in order to enter the political process. I think that is the system at the moment. But Hezbollah is effectively part of the Lebanese constitution. You cannot possibly describe it as a terrorist organization unless, of course, you're towing the Israeli line, because Hezbollah is the nemesis for Israel, because Hezbollah is committed to the liberation of Palestine. It is committed to the end of the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. Hezbollah inside Syria, again, what some people may not understand is that Hezbollah, to a large extent, grew out of the 1948 refugees that fled to Syria in areas like Zabadani, for example, close to Madaya. That is where Hezbollah actually generated from, to some extent. So the Palestinians who fled to Syrian territory once they were driven from their homes by the Israeli offense forces in 1948, then sort of grew and evolved into Hezbollah. But, you know, the Hezbollah then is certainly not the Hezbollah it is now. It is a professional military political organization. And it has been incredibly respectful of the Syrian government. It has fought alongside the Syrian army and its allies, but it has always been incredibly respectful of the directives from the Syrian government. It recognized the government in Damascus as being the sovereign nation government, and it has never deviated from that line. It has behaved incredibly professionally. And the fear from the United States, which is projecting the fear of its military outpost in the region, which is Israel, is that, of course, there will end up being a corridor from Iran to Palestine, effectively. And that is their biggest fear. I mean, Israel is now power multiplying, for example, the terrorist factions in the south that are acting as custodial guardians of the Golan Heights, which were illegally annexed by Israel. So right now, it's perceiving the threats from a strong axis of resistance being Iran, Russia, Syria, and Hezbollah. You know, Israel is a little bit on its back foot now. I mean, it had a plane shot down last week. It is under threat, and it knows it's under threat. So we have to be aware that you know, Israel could easily start ramping up hostilities. And we are seeing generally in Syria a very, very precarious time. I mean, we have the Syrian army potentially, it will probably do it through some some of the National Defense Forces, but stepping in to help the Kurdish factions in Afrin who are under attack from Turkey. So you potentially have a confrontation between Turkish and Syrian forces in Afrin, so on Syrian soil. You have the final cleansing of Idlib, so we're definitely going to see potential false flags there, because the US coalition will be very worried about what is going to be revealed if the whole of Idlib is liberated. And then, of course, you have Israel ramping up its influence in the south to, one, push forward and to take more territory other than its already annexed Golan Heights, but also to sort of push on the southern the southern part of Syria to try and distract it from the northern. So it's always this game of trying to distract the Syrian army away from its current campaign, to take it off in another direction, to try and weaken the intensity of its campaign, for example, right now in Ghouta. So we may well see Israel start to prod at the south to try and distract forces down to the south. So, you know, it's very hard to call, to be honest, Gary, because there are so many kind of sub battles going on inside Syria. But certainly, as far as Hezbollah is concerned, you know, the calling it a terrorist faction on a par with ISIS is ridiculous. I mean, you know, Hezbollah is not invading a sovereign nation. It is there at the invitation of the Syrian government. It has organically grown within that country, so it's not invading that country. ISIS is largely a foreign body that has entered Syria with the support, with the arming, and with the financing of the US coalition, and certainly armed and financed by client states of the US coalition, i.e. Saudi Arabia. And so that, you know, there is a huge difference here.
I just want to finalize a few thoughts before we sign off in about 2 minutes. Tonight on PBS, there will be a Frontline where they're going to have a discussion between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I'll bet anything that it doesn't give the true history of Iran. The CIA, it was first Truman, but it was Eisenhower that carried out with the CIA and the British the coup against Mossadegh, which led to the Shah of Iran taking power, and then all the tens of thousands of people who were arrested, killed, because they were not wanting to support the United States' hegemony in that area and the nationalization of British Petroleum. It is what they will leave out for anyone who knows true history, and they'll posit that Saudi Arabia is our ally, they're good, they're strong people, not realizing how much the Salafist and Wahhabism has done in all the minds of these kids in these madrasas, these religious schools sponsored all over the world by Saudi Arabia, recruiting the next generation of people who will be insensitive to the Sufis and to the Shia. And the United States is up to its eyeballs in being complicit in supporting Saudi Arabia. It's a mess. And also Trump leaving troops, not just leaving troops, but having a mandate to take over one-third of Syrian properties if somehow a sovereign nation doesn't have the right to determine who it invites in and who it wants to exclude. And we're supporting the Kurds. Now Turkey is going to be fighting those same Kurds. So at what point does that end up extending and conflating into a larger regional war? It is just one huge mess. And unfortunately, all of it could have been prevented. I want to thank you very much for coming in and sharing your insights and thoughts with us on all this. And we look forward to our next conversation with you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Gary. It's always a pleasure.
Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y, talking by Skype from Paris on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.